irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Happy Monday, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job. And for those of you tuning in the United States this week, very happy Thanksgiving to you. Before we get started with today's show, we'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors, the folks over at Markham Search. Markham Search offers premier recruiting services both on the temporary and direct hire side, as well as contingency and retained searches throughout the United States. So please do keep them in mind for all of your staffing needs. Today we have with us on the show Ellen Krug, also known as Ellie Krug. Ellie was an attorney, an Iowa civil attorney with over 100 trials, and transitioned from male to female in 2009. She later became one of the few attorneys nationally to try jury cases in separate genders. From 2011 to 2016, she served as the executive director of Call for Justice, LLC, a Minneapolis legal nonprofit that was conferred an American Bar Association Award for innovatively increasing legal access. She's also the author of Getting to Ellen, a memoir about love, honesty, and gender change. Ellie currently speaks, trains, and consults on diversity and inclusion topics to government entities, court systems, corporations, law firms, social service organizations, as well as colleges and universities. A hopeless idealist, Ellie has presented her diversity and inclusion program, Gray Area Thinking, across the country. In 2016, Advocate Magazine named Ellie as one of the 25 legal advocates fighting for trans rights. She's a monthly columnist for Lavender Magazine and pens a widely circulated monthly newsletter, The Ripple. Ellie views herself as an inclusionist and founded an inclusion-oriented consulting company, Human Inspiration Works, LLC, in late 2016. In January of 2017, Ellie launched her weekly radio and podcast show, Hidden Edges Radio, on AM 950 in the Twin Cities. The show highlights our commonalities as we each work to survive the human condition. A year later, she launched Ellie 2.0 about her belief in practical idealism and how each of us can play a role in fostering positive change in the world. Ellie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And I'm so humbled by that biography that I wrote. But thanks for having me.
I know, it's so funny, you know, when you're a speaker, or when you are on shows like this, you blush as you hear it, but then you also kind of have to let people know what you're about, right?
Oh, I know, but you know, you're going on and on and on. I'm like, oh, just, you know, but you got the most important part, which is, I get asked very often, you know, what do you want us to say in your bio? And I'm like, please don't read the whole bio. You don't have to do that. Well, what do you want us to say? And the important part is to say that I'm a hopeless idealist. And you did get that in, so thank you. And I am a hopeless idealist in a huge way.
Yeah, so could you share with us a little bit, Ellie? I mean, I was so fortunate. I remember hearing about you before I had met you. And so we both speak at conferences for the Association of Legal Administrators. And I remember it was the Denver conference, I think last year. And there was just a Twitter about you with all of the legal administrators in my local chapters here in California, who all came back just raving about this inclusivity seminar that they went to and how there was standing ovation. And then I was grateful that you and I happened to find each other at the same dinner at an event in Phoenix a couple of months ago. And I just remember just being awe-inspired and so excited to get to attend even part of one of your talks. So for those people who might not be as familiar with your work and the amazing work that you're doing in inclusion and diversity around the country and the world, can you share with our listeners a little bit about your story and about how you came to be Ellie 2.0?
Well, sure. I mean, you pretty well covered it in the bio. I'm going to be 62. And right now your listeners are like, why is she talking to a guy that, you know, is named Ellie? So, I mean, the listeners need to understand that, I am very, female in appearance, and I'm a little neurotic about that because it's radio and not TV. But yes, you're hearing a man's voice. And the reason for that is I did not transition genders until I was about 52 years old. And for much of that time, I was a trial lawyer first in Boston and then in Iowa, where I grew up, married my high school sweetheart, and for a long time suppressed. That's what a lot of transgender people do. That's becoming less necessary, although depending on what's happening in the political climate on a particular day, maybe more necessary. But fought myself for a very long time, and then ultimately had a moment of truth, and ultimately realized that one of the things in life you can't pick is your gender. And that caused a huge, huge turnaround in my life. I mean, before I transitioned, I was presenting as a very aggressive civil trial lawyer, very well respected in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. A bunch of oxymorons from what I just said there. But I had money, I had stature, I had a beautiful, beautiful, loving wife who was my soulmate. We were high school sweethearts before it was all over. We'd been together for 32 years by the time it fell apart. And I had two beautiful daughters. And I knew that if I transitioned genders, that if I allowed this thing inside me to come out, which was authenticity. I have a saying that authenticity will not leave you alone, and it certainly was not leaving me alone. It was yelling at me every day about the need to live authentically. I knew, though, that if it ever came out, I would lose everything that I had built, that I had worked to achieve, and it was really the American dream. And ultimately, I did come out, and ultimately, everything I listed for you, I did lose. And including my older daughter, I lost her for 4 years, and that was a really, really difficult thing. But ultimately, she came back, and she and I are very good right now. And so, that worked out. But when I was living and presenting as a man, I had been a student of Dr. King and Robert F. Kennedy ever since I was a kid. I mean, they were alive when I was alive. I mean, before they went, I read their words. I listened to them. I saw them on TV. I read their words in the newspaper. And they said that we have an obligation to change this world, to make this world a better place, to give people voices, people who don't have voices in our society right now. And so I had always been this idealist. But because I was fighting myself so vigorously to stay a man, I could never devote energy to being that idealist. And I also feared that if that idealist came out, that maybe all hell would break loose relative to me living authentically, because it was so core to my being, wanting to make a difference in the world. And so I suppressed a lot of things. And eventually, though, when I transitioned, I had a real choice whether to rebuild my law firm, because I did lose it, but if I had worked at it, I would have been able to rebuild it. It would have taken a lot of work and a lot of time. I had that choice versus just deciding, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to go live as who I really am, Ellie Krug, and I'm going to live authentically relative to being an idealist. And I chose that course, and that's where I am right now.
I know that, at least for me, and I'm sure I'm speaking for some of our listeners tuning in out there, just the courage it must take. I had a friend of mine, Rachel White, and this was probably 10 years ago, maybe even longer, 15 years ago. And I remember we were sitting having dinner one night, and she had a very, very similar story to yours, where, she was the, football quarterback who married the prom queen and had two beautiful daughters. And, when she made that choice, she lost everything. She lost her daughters for a while and went through a very similar situation. And I think that there are ways that all of us have experiences of not living our true lives, but how much are we willing to sacrifice to really lay it all out there and live our truth? And I just really acknowledge you for that, because to be that courageous, even in the face of no agreement in many parts of society, that just takes a lot of courage and bravery.
So, and Jennifer, with great kindness and gentleness, because we do have listeners, I'm sure, who are trans or gender nonconforming, I just need to just correct something that you said about your friend Rachel White. You used the word choice when she chose to be herself. The reality is it's not a choice. It's really who we are. The only choice that most trans people make is the choice of whether to live or die. That's really the only choice that we make. And I believed, I had believed for the longest time that I could choose to stay a boy, that I could choose to stay a man, that if I only got the right therapist or got the right mindset or got the right amount of alcohol in my system or the right amount of legal drugs, you know, for depression or the right toys or whatever, that I could, you know, that I could stay a man. And the reality is it's not a choice. It's just, it's not. And so I just needed to say that. And yeah, bearing in mind that tomorrow is Transgender Day of Awareness, which, you know, awareness about our lost trans folks due to violence, and you know, so just excuse me, it's Transgender Day of Remembrance. I know that I was off on that. Okay, Transgender Day of Remembrance is tomorrow. Sorry about that, community members, and so I just needed to say that very quickly, but. You know, people do say to me that you were brave, you know, to do what you've done. And frankly, what I did was just to survive. I mean, had I not done this, had I not transitioned, I am absolutely positive. I don't think I would be on this earth anymore. I just think it would have been too overwhelming. And so I got, you know, I found the strength to do what I needed to do. And I know there are countless millions of people right now that are struggling with gender identity, that are struggling to live authentically. Some of those folks are here in the United States, but there are other folks in country. I mean, right now there are eight or nine countries where I can be executed. I could be murdered by the government, legally murdered, and they're under their laws for being transgender. And so there are many people who don't get the luxury of being me, you know, being living authentically, and the pain is unimaginable for many of those folks. So, but I did transition, and when I did, I did say I'm going to go live totally as me, authentically, which you know meant transitioning to. I became a nonprofit executive director. I'd never run a nonprofit before. It was a nonprofit that helped connect low-income people with legal resources here in Minneapolis. But we won an American Bar Association Award within 3 years of opening our doors, which I thought was pretty cool. And you know, we started to make real inroads there about helping low-income people connect with lawyers who could, you know, help them on a pro bono or a low bono basis. A low bono is a reduced fee. But along the way, I started doing speaking. Right after I transitioned, people said, come talk to us. Tell us what's like to transition genders. Because in 2009, let me assure you, the landscape was much different than it is in 2018. It's, you know, it's only 9 years on the calendar. For the transgender community, it's about 50 years in terms of difference. And so I started, you know, informally speaking about what it meant to be trans. Then ultimately, I created a formal Trans 101 program. And then from there, though, I realized that there's actually a much greater hunger in our country on how to be welcoming to anyone who is other. And frankly, we can make anybody other. I mean, I could bring in 40, you know, a dozen 40-year-old blonde-haired dudes named Anderson, line them up against a wall, and we could make each one of them other. Oh, my goodness, look at how tall he is. He's so frumpy and short. Oh, my goodness. We could do that because that's what we humans do. And so, really, the work that, I mean, I do go around the country and talk about transgender topics, about what it means to be trans, what it means to transition genders. But much of my work, the vast majority of my work, is around the concept of human inclusivity, which is easily defined, the extent to which a human feels as if they matter to an organization or a group of other humans.
I think it's such an important topic, which is why I was so grateful that you agreed to be on the show, is inclusivity is something that everybody wants to feel like they belong somewhere. And, you know, we all spend 40 plus hours often at week in any sort of work or professional environment. And from the moment, you know, people go to grade school and then to their professional careers, there's this experience of lack of belonging or lack of understanding. So what I loved about the work you're doing is just the work that you're doing to help broaden people's perspectives, to not see one another as other. And, you know, you and I were talking, you know, before the show last week about, you know, it looks like we all hate each other, but what if people really like each other? So tell our listeners a little bit about that, about the work that you're doing and what's really going on out there in the world, what we think is going on versus what reality is.
Sure. So the starting point is understanding that to change the way people interact with others, we cannot command that. That it just does not stick to order people to be more inclusive, to be more welcoming. It just doesn't work. However, if we inspire them to be more inclusive, to want to get over their fear of other, their fear of people who are quote-unquote different from quote-unquote me, we can inspire them to do that, then that will stick. And so my work is grounded in that kind of principle around inspiration. I have a training called Bay Area Thinking, where I go in and speak at all kinds of organizations. You listed them in the intro, you know, everything from law firms to governmental entities to court systems to colleges and universities, Fortune 100 companies. And that training really is, you know, I don't operate with a PowerPoint. I don't use a podium. I mean, I need to have a little bit of room to roam around. I'm very, you know, energetic. I use my hands quite a bit. It's a lot of fun of myself. Very self-deprecating. And the whole goal is to get everyone to understand, first of all, to feel comfortable. But the whole goal is to get everyone to understand that we're all trying to survive the human condition together. We are. It's just that my survivorship, because my voice does not match my appearance, it's called passing. I do not pass 100% as female because of my voice. My survivorship of the human condition is far more public because of that. But the reality is, everyone I train, everyone who's hearing my voice right now, everyone in this world is attempting to survive the human condition. We all are. But we forget that. We think that we are alone, that there's no one that's got it like we do. We're the only ones. And the reality is there are so many of us that are walking in the same shoes. It's not even funny. And my goal is to remind people about that commonality. And we have an exercise in my gray area thinking training, which is about the first part of there are four modules to the training. The first is about how we group and label other humans and how we're tribal. And then I offer a couple of saving graces, how we can get past grouping and labeling and tribalism. That's the first module about how we group and label others. But the second module is how we group and label ourselves, because we do that as well. We separate ourselves from other people because we forget that other people are also suffering just like we are. And so I have an exercise called the identity game, where I put signs on the wall representing 19 different identities: age, race, gender, LGBTQ status, socioeconomic class. I've got a sign for family, one for not good enough / failure. I've got a sign for alone and afraid, and one for compassion. I get everybody to stand up for this identity game. I read them prompts. I give them prompts. Easy prompt at first, which is the identity my parents stressed for me as I was growing up. And usually people stand by education or religion, but I'm having more and more people that are standing under a sign that says not good enough as the identity that their parents stressed for them. It is so incredibly sad when we see that, but when we see that, you know what, our empathetic hearts start to open. And then we start to see those people in a different light than what we had seen before. And then the prompts continue. The second is the identity that garners or gives me the most privilege. With that one, we see a lot of white people standing under race. And then the third prompt is the identity that forms the basis to judge or discriminate against me. And we see a lot of people of color standing under race. But there are a lot of different identities there, and people are spread out on other signs. The fourth prompt is the identity I struggle with most on a day-to-day basis. When we get to that prompt, somewhere between a quarter and half the room, 25 to 50% of the room, stand under not good enough / failure. I'm not exaggerating whatsoever. That's in response to the prompt. the identity I struggle with the most on a day-to-day basis. And almost always, the people standing under that sign are the high flyers. I did this exercise last week in Richmond, and somebody was taking notes as we were doing the identity game because she said, Ellie, I want to tell you about the audience that you have here. And when we did the prompt about the identity that I, you know, struggle with the most on a day-to-day basis, we had some of the highest flyers in the legal community, young legal community in Richmond. We had a woman that had just been named, you know, one of the 40 top under 40 people in Richmond standing under that sign. And it's just, so again, it's to all of us to remember. And then the last prompt though, and I'll stop talking in a second here, Jennifer, I go on and on, of course, but the last prompt is the identity I want to be known for. And Jennifer, I am seeing across America, regardless of the venue, regardless of the sector, I am seeing when we get to the prompt, the identity I want to be known for, 95 to 99% of the room are standing under one of two signs, compassion or family. And out of those two, the vast majority are under compassion. And so what I am finding is that all of us want to be known as compassionate people. All of us, because family today is about compassion. Family is no longer about blood. It's about affinity. I've been best friends with somebody since eighth grade. I'm closer to his family than to my blood family. And so we all want to be known for compassion, but you know what? You go on social media right now, and that's the last thing anybody thinks, because you go on social media right now, everything that everybody thinks is we all hate each other. That's what people think. And that is so wrong. That is not what we want. That is not what I'm finding in my trainings. And that is, I mean, I'm going to talk to 12,000 people this year. I will stand in front of 12,000 people. And every one of them, almost every one of them, want to be known for compassion. That's a story no one is telling.
I think that gives us hope for humanity. You know, I think that we look out in the world, and I'm in California, and of course, there's so much death and destruction and people missing from the fires, or you look at any part of the country at any given moment, and there is poverty, there is lack, and there is sadness and hate. And I think that, unfortunately, it's whatever we shine the flashlight on that is what we all focus on as a society and as human beings. And I think it's beautiful that you're choosing to shine the flashlight on the fact that we do have this capacity for compassion. We do look for our similarities. You know, it was funny. I remember years ago, Ellie, there was an exercise I did in a training, and it just changed my life for the better. There was a question about what sort of contribution do you allow? What sort of contribution do you reject? And who do you allow or reject contribution from? And so in this breakout session that we did, you were instructed to think of five people who you just, you want the best for them. You'll allow them to contribute to you. You want the best for them. You wish nothing but happiness and joy for them, right? So you'd pick these five people. And then your goal is over the next 6 months to see and listen and look for the best in these people, allow them to contribute to you and vice versa. And then the next group of people is a number six person. So say somebody out there might not know you, Ellie, but they might think, gosh, this Ellie, I love what she's about. I love who she is in the world. I want the best for her. So your number six person is somebody who, you know, you may not be able to personally contribute to through words or actions, but maybe there's another way, just through thoughts or intentions, that they could want your success. But what I loved most about this exercise was what they affectionately called the number seven person. And the number seven person is the person who you don't want to contribute to. You will not allow them to contribute to you. You want nothing but for them to fall off a cliff. And the exercise that was leads me into what we're discussing right now is to find one thing that you could get behind that person. And when I was doing this workshop, it was actually right in the midst of the Trump versus Hillary election. And of course, there were very polarized people on both sides of the room who were for or against one or the other. And so the example the instructor gave is, what if, you know, you might disagree as a hypothetical with Trump, but what if you could get behind the fact that his family is important to him, or find that one commonality that you have, just like you said, it's right, compassion right. or family. And what if you could want good things for that person? And Ellie, I'll remember that, just much like, you know, being in the short part that I got to see about your talk as well, that was so memorable for me. I will remember that till the day I die. What if we connected to the number seven people in our life, the people who we didn't want the best things for, who we might consider adversaries? And what if we could look for that one thing that we could connect with them for and to wish something good for them coming from that place?
That's just a really great sentiment. It really is. You know, I actually believe that very few want a number seven in their life. I mean, I don't think most people want to be in disagreement or in fear of other people. I think most people want to be welcoming. It's just that we are so afraid of others. We have been taught to be afraid of others. We are hearing that every day from our political leaders about fear of others. But the reality is, you get two people who don't know each other, you get them to sit down. And I teach, people are like, well, what am I going to say to this person who's other? I teach what to say. And one of the things I offer is, all you have to do is ask another person, hey, do you have a kid in your life? That's all you have to ask. And most people have a kid. They've either got a kid, born to them or adopted to them, or they've got a niece or a nephew, or they've got a kid of their best friend, or somebody that, you know, hey, I was just at my niece's or nephew's, you know, birthday party. Tell me about your niece or nephew. Tell me about your kid. And then they'll tell me about your kid. And you know what? That's all you have to do. That's all you have to do, because people love to talk about their children in their lives. And I mean, Jennifer, you and I were doing that just before we got on the line here. I was telling you about a kid that's in my life. And so, you know, they do that. And once we do that, then that leads to other conversations, and it leads to all these commonalities. Oh, my goodness, can you believe the time on the screen that they do? Oh, yes. Oh, he loves soccer, too. And then you just suddenly, you're finding all of these connections that you have, all because you are able to get past other. You are able to get past fear of other. And, you know, I've got a monthly newsletter, The Ripple. If your listeners want to find out about it, all they have to do is go to elliekrug.com and go to, on the menu bar, look for newsletter, and they can click on past newsletters. My newsletter came out for this month today. And in it, I have a story of a senior, probably 70 years, white woman who went up to a black man half her age in an Indiana McDonald's, Nobleville, Indiana McDonald's, went up to him, total stranger, and said, I see you're sitting alone, you know, would you like to have some company?
Wow.
And the man said, yes. They sat down and they had a conversation. And somebody, you know, like a total stranger is like taking a photo of this thing. I can't believe this is happening in America, which, of course, makes me so incredibly sad that we have to make a big deal out of the fact that two strangers met each other and talked. But, you know, the person recording the account, you know, went on to say, you know, they were laughing like they were old friends. And I saw them go out into the parking lot, exchange phone numbers, you know, and then track down the woman later on, said that it was a really great experience, and she hopes to see the man again as a friend. I mean, that's all it takes. Just getting over our fear of other. And so Jennifer, it works with me because it does not work between my voice and my appearance. So as soon as somebody hears me speak in the room, many of them are like, whoa. They give me what I call the look, which is their eyes telling one thing, ears telling them something else, and brain getting scrambled, causing fight or flight to kick in, which creates a quick look with the eyes. But soon they understand, as they hear me, that I've got some of the same stuff going on as them. You know, I make fun of myself like sometimes they make fun of themselves. I want the same things for my kids as they want for their kids. And not everyone, but I get many on board because they understand that we're all in this together. We are. And you know, with the horrible fires that are going on out in California, and oh my goodness, my heart goes out to the folks affected by those fires. But the reality is, those fires are not separate from us. you know, on the most basic sense, half this country right now is breathing, you know, the air from those fires. But many of us are tied to those folks, you know, through employment or through family or through our empathetic hearts. No one is alone.
And that's the thing, I think, is that we all just feel like we're all alone by ourselves, you know, whether at the workplace or in, you know, unhealthy relationships, we all just feel like nobody else knows our pain. And it's funny, Ellie, one of my favorite books I've ever read that I will stick with me for the rest of my life is a book called One Amazing Thing. And what I love about the story is it starts off in a nondescript city. And in case any of you out there ever want to read it, I'm not giving anything away. This says it on the jacket of the book. And there are these 9 characters in the book. And the author does such a wonderful job of getting you to judge them very early on in the book. One person is Muslim, another person is an adulterer, and the author gets you to really develop these strong opinions one way or another for these characters. And very quickly into the book, there's a horrible earthquake. They're all waiting in line for a visa, and they don't know if they're going to live or die. And this one gentleman who's an ex-Marine says, okay, I'm going to, you know, hand out different waters and so forth, but we have to hunker down now for a little bit until somebody comes to try and get us out of here. And until we do, we have this time. So what if we all went around and we shared the one amazing thing that makes us who we are? And as you hear each character, even the ones you sorely detested very early on in the book, and you hear their one amazing thing, your entire perspective of that character, their relationship, their dynamic shifts. And I think it ties into what you're saying is, what if we all just knew not even an amazing thing, but just one thing about another person without just jumping to judgment or conclusion about that person?
Absolutely. I mean, we group and label, you know, I don't like to use the phrase unconscious bias because many in the audience, when they hear that, they just feel like they're being judged or they're like, why do I have to be here? I don't have any bias. So instead, I use the phrase grouping and labeling because we do group and label other humans. Even I do as the trainer. I group and label. And when we do that, we just put people in categories simply mainly because of their appearance, color of skin or their age or their gender or what appear to be their socioeconomic class. But the reality is you can never tell anybody's story ever by how they appear. And that identity game, the thing I explained about people standing by signs in response to prompts, you know, you have people standing under signs, right? If we have enough time, I give people, I ask people, anyone want to share why they're under a sign? And every time somebody shares, I am always surprised. I would never have known that about them. I would never have guessed that's why you're under the sign. And the net result, of course, is that they're under the sign because they're trying to survive the human condition. And then I'm like, you know what? Yeah, I hear you. We've got that same thing going on, you know, or I have a best friend who's got the same thing going on, you know, and then it draws us together. I mean, you're familiar with Brene Brown, of course, I'm a huge Brene Brown fan and the power of human vulnerability. It is true. When we are vulnerable, when we are willing to get past the superficial, the hi, how are you? Oh, how's the weather? We get past that. Talk about the stuff deep in our hearts, stuff that we don't show, but the stuff that so important to us about our lives, about how we're trying to make our way. When we share about that, we grab other people. We grab their hearts because we're being vulnerable. And those folks can see themselves in us. And eventually we're all seeing each other in each other. I have great hope for our country. I do, Jennifer. I have great hope. My biggest frustration, though, is that this message that we're talking about the power of human compassion, that all people want a pathway to exercise their empathetic hearts, that people really want to learn how to be good to others, how to be welcoming to others, that all of that messaging, I'm just a small person. I'm just a tiny speck, you know, on a pinhead trying to get that message out. And for me, it's frustrating because I'm just an army of one. You know, yes, I have a newsletter. Yes, it reaches 6,000 people. Yes, okay, and I've got a radio show in Minneapolis. But still, with all of that, my message is just droned out, and that is frustrating for me. So for that, I'm very grateful that you're having me on your show, so thank you.
Yeah, I think it's a message worth spreading. And especially too, in the employment world, you know, some listeners out there might be thinking, well, why are Ellie and Jennifer talking about this on a show called Get Yourself the Job? And I'll tell you, the very reason why is because look at our lives. Look at how many people our lives touch. No matter what sort of life you have, even if you're a truck driver driving across the country, you're still going to interact with people. And the more that we can bring awareness to our biases, unconscious or otherwise, what would that do? I mean, I've seen it for so many years, and it's only recently come to light, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years in the recruiting world, where people tend to hire people like themselves. Like, you might have an executive at a company, and through no fault of their own, they have a lot of little mini-me's running around of people who are very similar to them, who that's what they feel comfortable with, so that's who they hire. And I remember I had a chief inclusion officer of a company on the show in the last year. And what she was saying that some people are considering doing is actually going to blind interviews, much the way that orchestras are now auditioning people just to make sure that they're not inadvertently casting a bias towards somebody in the orchestra or in the symphony, is that doing the same thing. Because whether we're talking about a name on a resume or whether we're talking about somebody who's in person who might not line up with what physically might be acceptable for the position, think of all the great people that we're losing. And how do we, whether you're the hiring person or whether you're somebody going to interview, prevent ourselves and not group and label, or at least if we are grouping and labeling, have that aha moment to realize, wow, I'm doing that thing that Ellie mentioned on Jen's show. I'm grouping and labeling. How do I choose differently?
Well, and that's right. I mean, my work is about employment. It is about, you know, we have a looming job employee shortage in our country. It is coming. And what's going on, of course, with the restrictions on immigration is it's going to make that job shortage even more severe. And in the end, it's going to be a question about attracting diverse talent, because that's really what we need to have in our country. And we're going to need to be drawing from diverse people who historically have not been drawn from, okay, because they've been grouped and labeled and they've been marginalized in a variety of ways. And then it is once we have them, and I've got quotation marks around that word, them, in the workplace, how are we going to make them feel as if they matter? How are we going to keep them? And, you know, employers spend a heck of a lot of time on diversity, you know, on recruiting diverse team members and, you know, getting people ready to do that interview about where you search for diverse team members. People are spending so much time on that. But then what happens once we have, quote unquote, them in the workplace, we forget about them. We feel like, oh, we did good. We got them in the workplace. Look at us. And then we just forget about them. And we go back to our old ways. Yep, I'm going to go out to lunch with my same old buds who all happen to be all the same color as me and the same socioeconomic class, and same educational background and colleges and all of that stuff. We're all going to go to lunch. You know, and they forget about the diverse team member. They, you know, and what my work is reminding that that's not an inclusive workplace. That is not a place where people are going to feel as if they matter. And by the way, for those who are wondering, oh, Ellie, you just got a really nice heart, and this is kind of wonderful. But, you know, really, in the end, it's about dollars and cents. Well, guess what? You bring somebody in, you spend 2 years training them, equipping them, investing in them, and then they walk out the door after those 2 years before you've even started to get a return on your investment. You might as well burn that money. You know, whatever it costs for those 2 years to have that person there, you might as well just go and burn the money, because it does you no good. And by the way, now that person's going to walk out the door and they're going to badmouth your organization to other people within their community because you didn't treat them inclusively. You didn't make them feel as if they mattered. And I'm not like talking, you got to have champagne and confetti to make somebody feel that they matter. It's as simple as seeing them as a human and saying, hey, that was a really great job that you did. Or seeing an article on the internet, and it reminds you about this person, something they share because you got to know them. And then just simply printing off the article. I'm a big believer in printing things off. I don't want to kill trees, but having something granular, printing the article off and writing a note on it saying, I read this, thought of you immediately. Let me know what you think, you know, and then giving it to that person. Now, suddenly you've drawn that person in. Suddenly you've made that person feel as if their opinion matters. Suddenly you have seen that person in a way that they had not been seen before. That is what human inclusivity is all about in the workplace.
I love that, Ellie. Well, you and I could talk for hours about inclusivity and all the amazing work that you're doing to, you know, help bring awareness to this around the country and the world. But with our limited time, unfortunately, we don't have a lot more time on the show today. And I would love to know if there are any other points or tidbits or something that you would love our listeners to take away from today's show.
Well, yes. I mean, I absolutely would like everybody to remember that. And I don't want to get political here, okay, but that this thing about the American dream is really important. And what is the American dream? The American dream is essentially that our children will do better than what we do, or at least as good, okay, that we don't have to fear that they're going to go backwards. And this American dream, the more that I talk with people around the country, this is at great risk. And how do we get past that? We get past that by having to think differently than what we're doing. And so, and that means we have to shift our focus to our kids. I don't want to be political here, but Jennifer, the election, the midterm elections, yes, we had there was a turning point. It looks like there was a blue wave and that kind of thing. But even with that, I did not hear a whole lot of focus on the kids. And if we can turn our country's focus to our children, regardless of the color of those kids, regardless of the financial or socioeconomic class of those kids, we can turn our focus to the idea that we want our children to thrive and succeed and do better than us. If we can have that kind of focus, then we must have conversations where we can get past our differences, where we can get past the great divide that divides us right now. Not talking about the children enough. We need to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, all the times I've had people on the show, I don't think we've really talked about kids. And there's all these conversations about emotional intelligence and how to develop that. And I think that that's something that is important to instill in our children, because if we create and help foster emotional intelligence in the upcoming generations, that's going to create greater inclusivity, happiness, and, you know, opportunities for everybody coming to work in a collaborative way rather than an adversarial way.
Well, I'm even thinking in bigger scale. I mean, I'm thinking about how we need to change the way the education system is so that we're not making it harder for people to go to school, but making it easier for them to go to school. I mean, the one thing that I do see, I mean, I did a training 2 weeks ago in Milwaukee, and in the morning of one training, I had a black woman standing under education who said she grew up under in very poor circumstances, but her mother told her always stressed education for her because her mom said that's one thing that no one can ever take away from you. And later that day, I had a white woman standing under the same sign identifying education. And quite unbelievably, this is a whole different setting. I mean, it's a different venue where the second one is going. And it's a white woman who grew up poor. And she said the very same thing as the black woman had said earlier, which is, my mom told me that if I get an education, no one can ever take that away from me. Mm-hmm. And so education is the great leveler. It is the great leveler. And for your listeners about jobs, what I say is this. Think differently. People do not need to have a diploma, a degree from a blue ribbon university. Look instead to see what age were they? Did they start working? How much were they working in college? How did they get that B grade average and work 38 hours a week while in college? You know, and no, they didn't go to a top grade school, but they got a degree. And it is about persistence. I cannot stress enough the word persistence. So, okay, you see, you started. You got me back onto a soapbox. I did not mean to go there, Jennifer.
No, it's great, Ellie. I love it. And I want to make sure people can continue to follow you and find information and find your newsletter. So go ahead and tell people where they can look you up and find information about your radio show, your newsletter, the stuff you're doing in the world.
All right. So the name is Ellie Krug, K-R-U-G. I've got a website, elliekrug.com. You can go there and see all kinds of work. I have a company, Human Inspiration Works, LLC. There, we've got a website for that, Human Inspiration Works, LLC. HumanInspirationWorks.com. And then I have a radio show on AM 950 in the Twin Cities. All you have to do, literally, is just Google Ellie Krug, and E-L-L-I-E-K-R-U-G, and all kinds of stuff will come up. I mean, I've got a Wikipedia page. I have written a book, Getting Llewellyn, a memoir about love, honesty, and gender change. The book is 5 years old. It continues to sell very well. 5-star rating on Amazon. I think we're in the 50s with reviews. So I'm trying. And Jennifer, I cannot tell you enough how grateful I am that you had me on your show. Thank you so very much. I just really thank you for giving me an opportunity to be a hopeless idealist.
I love it. It's my pleasure, Ellie. From the moment I had first heard about you from that first Denver conference, I thought to myself, and I'm pretty good at manifesting what I want. God, she sounds amazing. I would love to hear her speak. And then voila, you popped into my life in Arizona in August, and I'm delighted to have been able to share your wisdom and to have you share your wisdom with all the listeners today. So thank you so much for your generosity and sharing.
Well, thank you. And you popped into my life as well. So I'm really grateful. So thank you. Thanks again for the great opportunity.
Yeah, so we're just having gratitude in abundance, which is very apropos for this Thanksgiving week here in the United States. So wishing everybody again a very happy Thanksgiving out there in the U.S. or wherever in the world you might be celebrating. It doesn't take but a moment just to connect to gratitude in one area of your life and somebody or something that you can be grateful for. And I've personally found that's made a big difference in my life. And on the note of emotional intelligence, which we were just speaking about, I invite you to tune in next Monday evening at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time as we talk to Sharon Schweitzer about the 5 different types or ways to connect to emotional intelligence in the workplace. And do keep in mind, if you miss any part of today's show or any future shows or past shows that you want to connect to, you can always go to iTunes under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes, or download on the Get Yourself the Job page on LA Talk Radio's website. At the bottom of the page is a download for all the archives of any prior shows we've done as well. So thank you so much. I am grateful to every one of you out there tuning in now or in the future, whenever you might tune in. And a big thank you to you again, Ellie, for joining us today.
Thanks so very much, Jennifer. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.